Chapter 9. Worthy Rival. Whenever I heard his name, it made me uncomfortable. If I heard someone sing his praises, a wave of envy washed over me. I know him to be a good person and a nice guy. I respect his work a great deal, and he has always been nice to me when we've met in professional settings. We do the same kind of work, write books, and give talks about our views of the world. Though there are many others who do similar work to his and mine, for some reason, I was obsessed with him. I wanted to outdo him. I would regularly check the online rankings to see how my books were selling and compare them to his. Not anyone else's, just his. If mine were ranked higher, I would smile a gloaty smile and feel superior. If his were ranked higher, I would scowl and feel annoyed. He was my main competitor, and I wanted to win. Then something happened. We were invited to share a stage at the same event. Though we had spoken at the same events before, this was the first time we would actually be on the stage at the same time. In the past, I would speak on day one of a conference, for example, and he on day two. This time, however, we would be on stage at the same time, sitting side by side for a joint interview. The interviewer thought it would be fun if we introduced each other. I went first. I looked at him. I looked at the audience. I looked back at him, and I said, "You make me unbelievably insecure, because all of your strengths are all of my weaknesses. You can do so well the things that I really struggle to do." The audience laughed. He looked at me and responded, "The insecurity is mutual." He went on to identify some of my strengths as areas in which he wished he could improve. In an instant, I understood the reason why I felt so competitive with him. The way I saw him had nothing to do with him. It had to do with me. When his name came up, it reminded me of all the areas in which I grappled. Instead of investing my energy on improving myself, overcoming my weaknesses, or building on my strengths, it was easier to focus on beating him. That's how competition works, right? It's a drive to win. The problem was, all the metrics of who was ahead and who was behind were arbitrary, and I set the standards for comparison. Plus, there was no finish line, so I was attempting to compete in an unwinnable race. I had made a classic finite mindset blunder. The truth is, even though we do similar things, he isn't my competitor. He is my rival, my very worthy rival. To anyone who has spent time watching or playing games and sports, the notion of a finite competition, where one player or one side beats the other to earn a title or prize, is familiar. Indeed, to most of us, it is so ingrained in the way we think that we automatically adopt an us-against-them attitude whenever there are other players in the field, regardless of the nature of the game. If we are a player in an infinite game, however, we have to stop thinking of other players as competitors to be beaten and start thinking of them as worthy rivals who can help us become better players. A worthy rival is another player in the game worthy of comparison. Worthy rivals may be players in our industry or outside our industry. They may be our sworn enemies, our sometimes collaborators, or colleagues. It doesn't even matter whether they are playing with a finite or an infinite mindset, so long as we are playing with an infinite mindset. Regardless of who they are or where we find them, the main point is that they do something, or many things, as well as or better than us. They may make a superior product, command greater loyalty, are better leaders, or act with a clearer sense of purpose than we do. We don't need to admire everything about them, agree with them, or even like them. We simply acknowledge that they have strengths and abilities from which we could learn a thing or two. We get to choose our own worthy rivals, and we would be wise to select them strategically. There is no value in picking other players whom we constantly outflank simply to make ourselves feel superior. That has little to no value to our own growth. They don't have to be the biggest players or any of the incumbents. We choose them to be our worthy rivals because there is something about them that reveals to us our weaknesses and pushes us to constantly improve, which is essential if we want to be strong enough to stay in the game. From the mid-1970s into the 1980s, Chris Evert Lloyd and Martina Navratilova were two of the dominant players in women's tennis. Though they were competitors when they met on the court, each driven to win, it was the respect they had for each other that helped both of them become better tennis players. "I appreciate what she did for me as a rival, to lift my game," Lloyd said once, speaking fondly of Navratilova, "and I think she appreciated what I did for her." It was because of Navratilova, for example, that Evert had to change the way she played. She could no longer rely on spending time on the baseline. She had to learn to become a more aggressive player. This is what a worthy rival does for us. They push us in a way that few others can, not even our coach. And in the case of Evert and Navratilova, it elevated their own games and the game of tennis. The impact of this subtle mind shift can be profound in how we make decisions and prioritize resources. Traditional competition forces us to take on an attitude of winning. A worthy rival inspires us to take on an attitude of improvement. The former focuses our attention on the outcome, the latter focuses our attention on process. That simple shift in perspective immediately changes how we see our own businesses. It is the focus on process and constant improvement that helps reveal new skills and boosts resilience. An excessive focus on beating our competition not only gets exhausting over time, it can actually stifle innovation. Another reason to adjust our perspective towards seeing strong players in our field as worthy rivals is it helps keep us honest. It's like a runner who is so obsessed with winning, they forget the rules, ethics, or why they started running in the first place. They may spend time and energy to undermine someone who is running faster than they are and resort to tripping their competitor. Or perhaps they will take performance-enhancing drugs to give them a secret edge. Both tactics will absolutely increase the chances they will win the race, but such strategies will leave them ill-equipped for success beyond those races. And eventually, those strategies run dry, and they are still left a slow runner. When we view the other players as worthy rivals, it removes the pressure of being in a win-at-any-cost struggle, and so by default we feel less need to act unethically or illegally. Upholding the values by which we operate becomes more important than the score, which actually motivates us to be more honest. Organizations or politicians who choose to do the right thing rather than what helps them get ahead are good examples. As for my worthy rival, when I thought of Adam Grant as a competitor, it didn't help me. Rather, it fed my finite mindset. I was more concerned with comparing arbitrary ratings than I was with advancing my own cause. I devoted too much time and energy to worrying about what he was doing rather than focusing that energy on how I could be better at what I do. Since that day, when I learned to shift my mindset, I no longer compare my book rankings to Adam's, or anyone else's for that matter. My mindset has shifted away from channeling my feelings of insecurity against him to partnering with him to advance our common cause. We have become dear friends. He kindly gave this book a proofread and helped me make it better. And I feel genuine happiness when I hear his name or see that he's doing well. I want his ideas to spread. In fact, everyone listening to this book should also go listen to Give and Take and Originals. They are both essential listening in and out of the business world. Fun fact, in an infinite game, we can both succeed. Turns out people can actually buy more than one book. An infinite mindset embraces abundance, whereas a finite mindset operates with a scarcity mentality. In the infinite game, we accept that being the best is a fool's errand, and that multiple players can do well at the same time. Worthy rivals can help us get better at what we do. When Alan Mulally left the airplane manufacturer Boeing commercial to become the CEO of the ailing Ford Motor Company in 2006, it would be the start of a journey that would result in one of the greatest turnarounds in automotive history. After the formal press conference to announce his new job at Ford, Mulally fielded some questions, One reporter asked what kind of car he drove. "Alexis," Mullally replied. "It's the finest car in the world." The new CEO of Ford just admitted that the car made by Toyota that he drove was better than anything Ford made. To some, it was sacrilege. But to Mullally, a man who prefers the truth even when it's uncomfortable, it was an honest assessment. In the 15 years before Mullally took over, Ford had lost 25% market share. Now it was headed towards bankruptcy. Indeed, Mullally needed a turnaround strategy, but first he wanted to learn as much as he could about the company. He wanted to understand Ford's health beyond the balance sheet. One of the things he learned was that consumers were disenchanted with the brand. Ford cars, at least in the United States, had a reputation for being unexciting, unreliable gas guzzlers. Perhaps this was part of the reason people weren't buying Fords like they used to. Historically, Detroit's car companies, including Ford, were obsessed with market share as a primary metric for comparison. However, Mullally knew that some of the most profitable car companies in the world were also some of the smallest. He understood quickly that it wasn't in Ford's long-term interest to just grow market share, something that could be accomplished with sales promotions and cost-cutting, which was exactly the turnaround plan Ford presented to Mullally when he arrived. That strategy would only work for a few years. "We're not going to chase market share," he said. "We're not going to put out vehicles where demand is not there and then discount and make it even worse." If Ford was to stay in the game, they would have to change the way they played the game. And that meant it had to relearn to make cars that people actually wanted to drive. One of the first things Mullally did after joining the company was to start driving home in a different model Ford every night. After trying every single car the company made, he asked to drive home a Toyota Camry. The only problem was, Ford didn't have one for him to drive. It was common practice for Ford to buy the cars of other manufacturers so their engineers could take the car to pieces to see how they are made. But there were none available for anyone to actually drive. Think about that for a second. The senior executives of a major car company that was struggling to sell cars had little idea what anyone else's cars were actually like to drive. If car buyers test drive their options, shouldn't Ford's executives know what they're trying? Mullally had the company buy a whole fleet of cars made by other companies and instructed his senior managers to drive them. When he called the Lexus the finest car in the world, Mullally wasn't trying to make the people at Ford feel bad. He was offering them a worthy rival. He was convinced that in order to save Ford, they would need to be frank about the state of their own products and processes and respectful students of the other players in their industry. Toyota was a company that, as Mullally describes it, makes products that people want, with less resources and less time than anybody in the world. They were a benchmark against which Ford could push themselves to improve the quality of their own cars and how they made them. And if they could pull that off, the profits would follow. For Mullally, the reason to study the other car manufacturers wasn't simply to copy them or outsell them, but to learn from them. "I was never trying to beat GM or Chrysler," Mullally says. "We were always focused on the just cause, and we used our benchmarking against our competition as data insights on where we could continuously improve our operation. Continuously improving their process would help them make better products, which would help them be more effective at advancing Henry Ford's original just cause, to provide safe and efficient transportation for everyone, to open the highways to all mankind." Henry Ford's cause also served as a filter for other decisions. Mullally sold off brands like Jaguar, Land Rover, and Volvo, for example. Ford originally bought them so they could compete in as many automotive categories as possible, something Mullally believed distracted Ford from why the company was founded in the first place. Then came the 2008 stock market crash, which was particularly devastating for the U.S. car industry. Without a government bailout, GM and Chrysler would go bankrupt. Thanks to a nearly $24 billion loan that Mullally had taken out in 2006 to help Ford reinvent itself, combined with the steady improvements the company was making in its operations and products, Ford would be able to weather the downturn without any government assistance. So when Mullally showed up to testify in front of Congress before the bailouts were given, he could have insisted that the government not give any money to GM or Chrysler. A CEO who sees the other players as their competitors would have relished watching them go bankrupt, leaving Ford as the only major U.S. car manufacturer to survive. Surely that's winning. Because Mullally saw the other car makers as worthy rivals, he actually endorsed the bailout. He knew that keeping those companies around would only serve to help make Ford a better company. He also knew that Ford's rivals were part of a larger ecosystem. If they went bankrupt, so would many other suppliers, which could also destroy Ford. So Mullally put together plans to also help many of the auto suppliers weather the downturn. Unfortunately, the leaders of the troubled GM and Chrysler, still operating with a finite mindset, rejected Ford's request to work together for the good of the industry. In contrast, Honda, Toyota, and Nissan did work with Ford to keep major suppliers, on which they also relied, in business. The infinite-minded players understood that the best option for their own survival, and indeed the ultimate goal of an infinite leader, is to keep the game in play. Worthy rivals can help us get clearer on why we do what we do. By the early 1980s, the computer revolution was in full swing. And for Apple, one of the companies that was leading the computer revolution, the true value of their rival had little to do with product improvement. It was bigger than that. Their worthy rival helped them better clarify their cause and rally their people. The mere existence of their rival reminded everyone inside and outside the company what they stood for, the reason they went into business in the first place. They were the Navy, we were the pirates. During the 1970s, IBM had the lion's share of the market in mainframe computers, huge, room-filling machines that offered companies massive computing power. But IBM resisted developing their own microcomputers, as they used to be called, believing them to have insufficient computing power to meet a business's needs. Personal computers, IBM believed, had no place in the office. That all changed in 1981. Seeing how well the pioneers of personal computing, Commodore, Tandy, and Apple, were doing getting their products to businesses, IBM changed its tune. Flush with cash, IBM was able to invest massive amounts of money to develop their own personal computer. They paid exorbitant salaries to steal some of the best and brightest engineers in the business from other companies, including Apple. And in just 12 months, IBM introduced its PC to the world. Apple had the biggest market share in personal computers before IBM showed up, which meant they had the most to lose when IBM entered the market. Whereas a finite-minded player would likely panic at such news, an infinite-minded player, like Apple, did the exact opposite. In August 1981, in the same month IBM's PC first went on sale, Apple ran a full-page ad in the Wall Street Journal with the headline, "Welcome, IBM. Seriously." The rest of the ad tells us everything we need to know about how Apple viewed this new player, not as a competitor, but as a worthy rival. "Welcome to the most exciting and important marketplace since the computer revolution began 35 years ago," read the opening sentence of Apple's ad. "Putting real computer power in the hands of the individual is already improving the way people work, think, learn, communicate, and spend their leisure hours," the ad continued. "Over the next decade, the growth of the personal computer will continue in logarithmic leaps. We look forward to responsible competition in the massive effort to distribute this American technology to the world. And we appreciate the magnitude of your commitment, because what we are doing is increasing social capital by enhancing individual productivity." Apple signed the letter to their new rival with the words, "Welcome to the task." Apple was trying to advance a just cause, and IBM was going to help them. IBM accepted the challenge, and because of their dominance in the business world, IBM was able to leverage those relationships to sell their new personal computers into large companies. This made Big Blue, as IBM was affectionately called, the safe and obvious choice for any procurement manager who was responsible for buying PCs for their company. No one ever got fired for buying IBM. the saying went. To further grow their business, IBM allowed other computer makers to clone or use their operating system in their products. Apple refused to follow suit. If someone wanted Apple's operating system, they had to buy an Apple. Unable to clone Apple's OS, and because it was expensive to develop another operating system for the mass market, most other computer makers licensed IBM's operating system to produce IBM-compatible products. And with that, the PC became the industry standard in the business world and beyond. IBM helped Apple turn the personal computer into a necessity on every desk and a basic household appliance in every home. But IBM did much more than that for Apple. Apple used IBM as a foil to help tell the story of what they stood for in a way that was clearer and more compelling. Just causes exist in our imaginations, but companies and products are real. And for a person or a company with a clear sense of cause, that individual or organization itself can become the tangible symbol of their intangible vision. It's easier for us to follow a real company or a leader than an abstract idea. And it's easier for us to form a compelling narrative for our just cause when we can point to a tangible representation of the alternative. They were the Navy, predictable, sold to corporations, is how John Couch, one of Apple's early employees, described IBM. We wanted to be the pirates that empowered individuals to be creative. Like Republicans and Democrats, like the Soviet Union and the United States, IBM and Apple stood as symbols of alternative ideologies looking for followers. IBM represented business, stability, and consistency. Apple stood for individuality, creativity, and thinking differently. By playing up the contrasts to the public, Apple moved from being a leader in the personal computing revolution to being a leader of like-minded revolutionaries. Based on the standard metrics against which we measure the quality of a computer, price, speed, and memory, for example, PCs and Apples were basically equal. In fact, the IBM clones were often quite a bit cheaper. Where competitors almost always only compare the features and benefits of their products, Apple chose to engage with IBM on a level higher than that. Competitors compete for customers. Rivals look for followers. To Apple's followers, IBM was the past and Apple was the future. And to IBM devotees, Apple was a toy for creative types and IBMs were for serious people doing serious work. This was bigger than products and features. This was now a game of religion. The manner in which Apple responded to IBM entering the PC market was the total opposite of what normally happens. When a new company joins an industry with such force, it often spooks the incumbents. They frequently lose sight of their vision and start focusing on competing with the new player based on product comparisons and other standard metrics, which means if they weren't already playing with a finite mindset, the choice to view the new entrant as a competitor rather than a worthy rival will drag them into the finite quagmire before too long. This is exactly what happened to the Canadian cell phone maker, BlackBerry. Over a quarter of a century after IBM stormed into Apple's market, Apple did the same thing to BlackBerry. Except, unlike Apple's choice to view IBM as a worthy rival that could help them better clarify what they stood for, BlackBerry chose to see Apple as a competitor to be beaten, and they paid a hefty price for that finite-minded decision. Before the iPhone, BlackBerry was the second largest cell phone operating system in the world. Their high-performing, highly durable, and very reliable products made them the must-have option in government and in many companies. They owned the business market. Even after Apple introduced their iPhone in 2007, BlackBerry's momentum continued to carry them to a record-high 20% share of cell phone sales in 2009. As iPhones became more and more popular, however, BlackBerry panicked. BlackBerry's leaders could have chosen to draw a contrast between their philosophies and Apple's, as Apple had done with IBM decades before. They could have used Apple as a foil to highlight their own vision of the world, one that revolved around the security and reliability needs of business and government. But they didn't. Instead, BlackBerry responded to the iPhone's rising popularity by trying to copy it. First, they started offering apps and games for their existing devices, which dramatically slowed their product's performance. Then, they abandoned their iconic, full QWERTY keyboards and introduced touchscreen options. They never really worked as well as iPhones and were much less durable than BlackBerry's other models. Sadly, this is a common scenario. Disruption, remember, is often a symptom of a finite mindset. Leaders playing with a finite mindset often miss the opportunity to use a disruptive event in their industry to clarify their cause. Instead, they double down on the finite game and simply start copying what the other players are doing with the hope that it will work for them too. And in the case of BlackBerry, it didn't. They abandoned their chance to be leaders for a cause and opted to become followers of a product. Obsessed with trying to beat Apple, they actually lost sight of their own vision. They forgot why they went into business in the first place. And in short order, BlackBerry went into steep and steady decline. By 2013, the company had less than 1% market share, a nearly 99% drop in just 4 years. Where once they dominated, today BlackBerry is an insignificant player and no company's worthy rival. IBM served as Apple's worthy rival for many years. Eventually, as computers became ubiquitous and the market changed, IBM dropped out of the PC game. The loss of their rival did not mean Apple won, however. They quickly found a new symbol of safe, stable corporate-mindedness in Microsoft. I'm a Mac, I'm a PC, for those who remember. Like IBM, as Microsoft's own cause became fuzzier, it no longer offered the clear ideological contrast to Apple that it once did. So who is Apple's worthy rival now? Perhaps Apple's new worthy rivals are Google and Facebook. Google and Facebook now represent the big brother of the internet, always watching us, tracking our every move, in order to sell our data to companies who want to target their advertising to us, which helps Google and Facebook make more money. This has become an industry standard. Apple still seems to be fighting for the rights of individuals and challenging the status quo. The company has become an outspoken advocate for individual privacy. Unlike their rivals, Apple has decided not to sell the data they collect as a means of driving revenue. They have also stood up against the government and denied them access to our private text messages. Even though the world around them has changed, for over 40 years, Apple has found worthy rivals to help keep them focused on the very cause upon which the company was founded. Cause blindness. I have a friend who is so focused on her cause, it is as if she has forgotten that there are other points of view in the world besides her own. My friend, sadly, has labeled anyone who has a different opinion as wrong, stupid, or morally corrupt. My friend suffers from cause blindness. Cause blindness is when we become so wrapped up in our cause, or so wrapped up in the wrongness of the other player's cause, that we fail to recognize their strengths or our weaknesses. We falsely believe that they are unworthy of comparison simply because we disagree with them, don't like them, or find them morally repugnant. We are unable to see where they are in fact effective or better than we are at what we do, and that we can actually learn from them. Cause blindness blunts humility and exaggerates arrogance, which in turn stunts innovation and reduces the flexibility we need to play the long game. Less able to engage in any kind of honest or productive practice of constant improvement, we end up repeating mistakes or continue to do many things poorly. Plus, hubris increases the chances that any weaknesses our organization may have are left open to exploitation by other players. All of which contributes to the draining of will and resources we need to stay in the game. Whenever I try to show my friend that those players she finds despicable are really good at certain things, and she should respect them for that, she mocks me and thinks me a turncoat because I dare pay her competitor a compliment. As hard as it may be to recognize a player as one of our worthy rivals, especially if we find them disagreeable, to do so is the best way to become better players ourselves. The more I question these guys, the more I came to understand that the successful criminals were good profilers, explained John Douglas, retired FBI unit chief and pioneer of criminal profiling. Douglas understood that, as unconscionable as we all find serial killers, for example, the best way to catch one was to acknowledge that they were very good at the exact same thing that the FBI does, which meant the FBI had to be better. Having worthy rivals, criminals adept at evading the FBI, pushes the FBI to constantly improve their techniques. Having a rival worthy of comparison does not mean that their cause is moral, ethical, or serves the greater good. It just means they excel at certain things and reveal to us where we can make improvements. The very manner in which they play the game can challenge us, inspire us, or force us to improve. Who we choose to be our worthy rivals is entirely up to us, and it is in the best interest of the infinite game to keep our options open. Don't confuse losing your worthy rival with winning the game. It was soon after the fall of the Berlin Wall that the United States committed what may have been one of the greatest foreign policy blunders of the 20th century. America declared that it had won the Cold War, except it hadn't. By this point in the book, we all know the mantra, in the infinite game, there is no such thing as winning. This is true in business or in global politics. America didn't win the Cold War. The Soviet Union, drained of will and resources, dropped out of the game. The Cold War met all the standards of an infinite game. Unlike finite warfare, where there are agreed-upon conventions for play, easily identifiable sides, and a clear definition of when the war will end, for example, a land grab or some other easily measurable finite objective. In stark contrast, the Cold War was often played out with proxy players. There were no ground rules, and there was certainly no clearly defined objective that would signal to all sides that the war will end. As much as the United States and the West talked about defeating the Soviet Union and winning the Cold War, short of an all-out nuclear war, which was something neither side wanted, few could imagine or predict exactly what winning looked like. And there was no treaty that ended the Cold War. Instead, both sides kept playing, always trying to improve the manner in which they played, with an unknown sense of where it was all going. So when the Berlin Wall came down in 1989, it was not something either predicted would happen. Like in business, times change, and so do the players. And, like in business, if a big company goes bankrupt, it doesn't mean the game is over or that any company is the winner. The players left standing know that other companies will rise up and new ones will join the industry. When our most important worthy rival, the one who pushes us more than any other, drops out of the game, it does not mean that there are others on the bench waiting to immediately rush in to play either. It can take years for a new or different rival or rivals to replace them. The advanced player in the infinite game understands this and works to remain humble at the loss of a major rival. Cautious not to let hubris or a finite mindset take hold, they play knowing that it is just a matter of time before new players emerge. Patience is a virtue in infinite play. This was not how America acted. After the Soviet Union left the game, America suffered a sort of cause blindness and believed itself to be unrivaled. And so it acted accordingly. It acted like a victor. Even if well-intentioned, it started to impose its will on the world, unchecked for about 11 years. It anointed itself the world's police force, sending troops to the former Yugoslavia, for example, and imposing no-fly zones over sovereign nations, things that would have been much harder, if not impossible, to do if the Soviet Union were still around. Without identifying our worthy rivals, strong players start to falsely believe they can control the direction of the game or the other players. But that's impossible. The infinite game is like a stock market. Companies list and delist, but no one can control the market. Highly successful players with lots of money and many strengths can get away with ignoring their weaknesses for a while, but not forever. Fast-growing companies with strong products, marketing, and balance sheets, for example, often neglect to give time and attention to leadership training or to actively nurturing their culture. Things that can come back to haunt them later. Groupon is just one example. Hailed by the business press for their product innovation and rate of growth, the leaders neglected their people, which, when the growth slowed and other companies matched their product, became their Achilles heel. Uber is another example. They may have pioneered ride-sharing technology, but the company has suffered more because of a neglected culture than any product failing. When Dara Khosrowshahi replaced Travis Kalanick as CEO in 2017, it was done with the express purpose of fixing the company culture. America would have been well served to look for new worthy rivals that may have helped the nation prepare for the next chapter of the Cold War. The nation's leaders could have looked beyond strengths like military and economic might to focus on some of the weaknesses they had been neglecting for so many years. But that's not what happened. Relying on the manner of play it had developed and perfected during the years of Cold War 1.0, America was unable to see the rise of new rivals that aimed to check its actions and ambitions. Cold War 2.0. There are three tensions that govern the Cold War: nuclear, ideological, and economic. Not coincidentally, these things overlap with life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, as stated in the Declaration of Independence. For America and all nations, these things are existential. They are the things worth bearing any burden or paying any price to defend. During Cold War 1.0, all three of those tensions were conveniently co-located in a single rival, the Soviet Union. The two nations each possessed more nuclear weapons by an order of magnitude greater than all the other nuclear-armed nations combined. Both nations were ideological exporters, looking for allies and customers. America was spreading the gospel of democracy and capitalism, and the Soviets were proselytizers of communism. And their economies were the two largest economies in the world from the end of World War II until the fall of the Berlin Wall, the entire length of Cold War 1.0. Having one primary worthy rival has huge advantages. It provides for a single point of focus for strategies to be developed, resources to be allocated, and the attentions of internal factions to be pointed. Much was written after the events of September 11, 2001, about the lack of cooperation among America's intelligence services, for example. This wasn't a new development. Those agencies were always territorial and competitive with each other. The difference was, when America knew who its worthy rival was, when push came to shove, all the agencies could put aside their internal gripes to come together to face the common threat. Absent the identification of any new worthy rivals, the internal fighting among so many of America's institutions continued unchecked. Even Republicans and Democrats used to be able to agree that the Soviet Union represented a greater threat to the United States than each other and could always come together in a clear common cause. That is no longer the case. Absent any identified external worthy rival, the two parties now see each other as the existential threat to the nation. All the while, the real threats to America grow ever stronger. So while America was focusing its energies against itself, it failed to see that the Cold War was still alive and well. Except unlike Cold War 1.0, in Cold War 2.0, there is not one worthy rival, but many. The nuclear threat posed by the Soviet Union has been replaced by North Korea and others. The Soviet economic rivalry has been replaced by China, which is on course to surpass America's economy. The ideological rivalry that the Soviet Union represented has been replaced by extremists acting under the guise of religion. Plus, Russia still continues to test and check America's resolve when possible across all three tensions also. Like in business, the emergence of new players necessarily changes the way the game must be played. Blockbuster, the sole superpower in the movie rental business, failed to appreciate that a small company like Netflix and an emerging technology like the internet required them to re-examine their entire business model. Big publishers doubled down on old models when Amazon showed up, instead of asking how they could update and upgrade their models in the face of a new digital age. And instead of asking themselves, what do we need to do to change with the times, taxi companies chose to sue the ride-sharing companies to protect their business models instead of learning how to adapt and provide a better taxi service. Sears got so big and so rich from sending out paper catalogs for so many decades that they were too slow to adapt to the rise of big box stores like Walmart and e-commerce. And believing itself without rival, the behemoth that was MySpace, didn't even see Facebook coming. What got us here won't get us there. And knowing who our worthy rivals are is the best way to help us improve and adapt before it's too late. Without a worthy rival, we risk losing our humility and our agility. Failure to have a worthy rival increases the risk that a once mighty infinite player with a strong sense of cause will gently slide into becoming just another finite player looking to rack up wins. Where once the organization fought primarily for the good of others, for the good of the cause. Without that worthy rival, they are more likely to fight primarily for the good of themselves. And when that happens, when the hubris sets in, the organization will quickly find its weaknesses exposed and too rigid for the kind of flexibility they need to stay in the game. Chapter 10. Existential Flexibility. Some thought him mad. He began liquidating his assets and selling off property. He borrowed against his life insurance policy and even licensed the rights to his own name. With the company doing so well, why would he leave now to do something different, something so risky? But in 1952, that's exactly what Walt Disney did. He hadn't gone mad. What he had done was make an existential flex. Walt Disney was accustomed to taking risks and doing new things. As a young artist working in the emerging field of animation, Disney was constantly innovating. He was one of the first to make short films in which real actors would interact with cartoon characters. In 1928, he was the first to make a cartoon with synchronized sound in the animation classic Steamboat Willie. Dissatisfied with just making entertaining shorts designed to make an audience smile, however, Disney set out to make an animated film that was a believable substitute for reality, one that could elicit the full range of human emotions. And in 1937, he released the first ever feature-length animated film, Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. Snow White was like nothing the world had ever seen before. This evolution of Disney's work wasn't the result of experimentation for the sake of experimentation, nor was it driven by a desire to get rich or become famous. With each step, Disney was advancing his just cause, inviting audiences to leave the stresses and strains of life behind and enter into a more idyllic world of his creation. The seeds of Disney's just cause were planted when he was just a boy. When he was 4 years old, his father, Elias, moved the family from Chicago to live on a farmstead in rural Marceline, Missouri. The young Walt played outdoors, where there were often animals roaming around, where he was surrounded by extended family and a supportive community. It was, as his older brother Roy later recounted, just heaven for city kids. But that idyllic childhood didn't last long. Elias Disney's attempt at being a farmer ended in failure. And 5 years after they arrived in Marceline, the family was forced to move again. Landing in Kansas City, Elias bought a paper route and the young Walt was put to work to help the family make ends meet. But it didn't help. And as their financial struggles compounded, so did Elias's stress and temper. It reached a point, Walt Disney recalled, that to tell the truth with my father got me a licking. Fortunately, back on the farm, Disney had discovered drawing. A hobby that gave him a perfect escape from what he perceived as the hardships of real life. For the rest of his days, Disney would use his art and imagination to offer others a chance to escape their present circumstances too, to take them to a place where they could experience the kind of joy he remembered from his childhood in the little town of Marceline. To infinity and beyond. Walt Disney's ability to transport people to another world turned out to be quite profitable. In addition to the critical and popular acclaim, when Snow White came out, it grossed over $8 million in its first year alone, an equivalent of over $140 million in today's dollars. With the money and success generated from the film, Walt built a studio in Burbank, California, and a corporate culture that was, as former employee Don Lusk described, just heaven. To repay the debt accumulated from building the studio and fuel their growth, Roy Disney, CEO of Walt Disney Productions, wanted to take the company public. Walt opposed the idea for fear that shareholders would meddle in the business. Eventually, however, Disney succumbed to the pressure, and the company did go public. As the company grew, it faced a host of new challenges. For starters, the culture of Walt Disney Productions became more stratified. Perks that used to be offered to everyone, for example, were now only offered to more senior people. And as wage gaps increased, so did internal dissent. And for the first time, Disney faced hostile struggles with unions. The breakdown of Disney's Studio Utopia, combined with the pressure to do more cost-conscious live-action movies and the creative restriction he felt from the bureaucracy, left Disney feeling downright defeated about the future. Walt Disney Productions had become more finite and less visionary, and Disney became convinced that the business could no longer serve as a mechanism to advance his just cause. Despite his frustrations, his vision remained as infinite as ever, which is why Disney decided to make an existential flex. So he quit. 15 years after the original release of Snow White, Walt Disney left to do something new. Taking all the money he made from selling property, other assets, and his shares in Walt Disney Productions, combined with a loan he took out against his life insurance policy, in 1952, Disney formed a new company. He called it WED, after his initials, and set to work on a new project, one that he believed could advance his cause more than anything that came before, an actual place where people could go to escape the reality of their everyday lives. He was going to build the happiest place on earth. He was going to build Disneyland. Unlike the often dangerous and dirty amusement parks that existed in the day, which tended to be just collections of random rides, the place Walt wanted to build would be safe and immaculate and have a coherent story that ran throughout the park. There would be no signs of toil or trouble, nothing dark and seedy lurking in the shadows. Here, people would be fully immersed in a perfect illusion. I think what I want Disneyland to be most of all is a happy place, a place where adults and children can experience together some of the wonder of life, of adventure, and feel better because of it, said Disney. It is a place where you leave today and enter the world of yesterday and tomorrow. Whereas audiences could only watch movies, at Disneyland they could be in the movies. And unlike a movie, which is finite, the park was something that could keep evolving forever. In true infinite-minded fashion, Disney explained, Disneyland will never be finished. It's something we can keep developing and adding to. A motion picture is different. Once it's wrapped up and sent out for processing, we're through with it. If there are things that could be improved, we can't do anything about them anymore. I've always wanted to work on something alive, something that keeps growing. We've got that in Disneyland. Like so many entrepreneurs, Walt Disney put everything on the line when he started his businesses. Setting out to build Disneyland, however, was perhaps the biggest risk of all, because he didn't have to do it. He had a lot more to lose than he had had the first time. This is the plight of the infinite-minded visionary leader. Once he realized that the company was on a path that could no longer advance his cause, he was willing to put everything on the line to start over again. He didn't leave because he saw an opportunity to make more money. He didn't leave a failing business. He found a better way to advance his just cause, and he leapt at it. The vision for flexibility. Existential flexibility is the capacity to initiate an extreme disruption to a business model or strategic course in order to more effectively advance a just cause. It is an infinite-minded player's appreciation for the unpredictable that allows them to make these kinds of changes. Where a finite-minded player fears things that are new or disruptive, the infinite-minded player revels in them. When an infinite-minded leader, with a clear sense of cause, looks to the future and sees that the path they are on will significantly restrict their ability to advance their just cause, they flex. Or, if that leader discovers a new technology that is more likely to help them advance their cause going forward than the technology they are currently using, they flex. Without that sense of infinite vision, strategic shifts, even extreme ones, tend to be reactive or opportunistic. Existential flexibility is always offensive. It is not to be confused with the defensive maneuvering many companies undergo to stay alive in the face of new technology or changing consumer habits. Many newspapers and magazines uprooted their business models when they went digital, for example, not because they found a better way to advance their cause, but because they were forced to make the change in the face of a changing world. Though necessary to stay alive, that kind of change rarely inspires the people inside the organization or reignites their passions. An existential flex does. Many startups are fueled by an entrepreneur's passion for a vision than by the resources they have to advance it. An existential flex recreates that passion for something new at a time when the company is already enjoying success. When Walt Disney started over again with WED, he brought a group of people from the original company who wanted to go on the new adventure with him as if it were the first time. They were willing to share the risk, they were willing to put in the hours, they were willing to do whatever they had to do to make this new idea successful. They found Disney's enthusiasm infectious and were excited to once again do things they had never dreamed of. The flex also rejuvenated Disney's own passion. "Damn it, I love it here," he said of his new company. An existential flex doesn't happen at the founding of the company. It happens when the company is fully formed and functioning. To all the finite-minded observers, it is existential because the leader is risking the apparent certainty of the current profitable path with the uncertainty of a new path, which could lead to the company's decline or even demise. To the finite-minded player, such a move is not worth the risk. To infinite-minded players, however, staying on the current path is the bigger risk. They embrace the uncertainty. Failure to flex, they believe, will significantly restrict their ability to advance the cause. They fear staying the course may even lead to the eventual demise of the organization. Again, the motivation for an infinite-minded player to flex is to advance the cause, even if it disrupts the existing business model. To the finite-minded player, the reason not to flex is expressly to protect the current business model, even if it undermines the cause. And if the company is the vehicle a leader uses to advance their cause, then making a dramatic shift in strategy to keep a company going for a very long time in one form or another is also of paramount importance in the infinite game. Existential flexibility is bigger than the normal day-to-day flexibility required to run an organization, and we must not confuse shiny object syndrome with existential flexibility either. There is a whole category of frustrated employees around the world who work for well-meaning, sometimes visionary leaders who, like a cat reacting to a shiny object, want to chase every good idea they come across with, "This is it! We have to do this to advance the vision!" When an existential flex happens, it is clear to all those who believe in the cause why it has to happen. And though they may not enjoy the upheaval and short-term stress such a change may cause, they all agree it is worth it and want to do it. Shiny object syndrome, in contrast, often leaves people flummoxed and exhausted rather than inspired. When a visionary leader makes an existential flex, to the outside world, it appears that they can predict the future. They can't. They do, however, operate with a clear and fixed vision of a future state that does not yet exist, their just cause, and constantly scan for ideas, opportunities, or technologies that can help them advance toward that vision. Alan Mulally used his business plan review meetings at Ford to also look at what was happening in companies beyond his traditional competitors. "It's about always keeping an eye on all the things that are going on and learning from that," he explained. Where a more finite-minded leader is also looking for opportunities, Their gaze tends to be within their industries, on the balance sheet, or toward the horizon. An infinite-minded leader with a just cause looks outside their industry and miles beyond the horizon, to a place that requires imagination to see. This was certainly the case when Steve Jobs made an existential flex at Apple in the early 1980s. As I wrote about in the previous chapter, Apple had a very clear sense of cause, and the seeds of that cause were sown long before Apple was founded. Growing up in Northern California during the Vietnam War, the company's founders, Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak, were deeply mistrustful of the establishment. They loved the idea of empowering individuals to stand up to Big Brother. During the computer revolution of the 1970s, the two young entrepreneurs saw the personal computer as the perfect tool for individuals to challenge the status quo. They imagined a time in which, thanks to the personal computer, individuals would have the power to stand up to a corporation, maybe even compete with them. After the launch of the Apple I and the Apple II, Apple was already a highly successful company. They were working on their next product iteration at the time when, in December 1979, Jobs and a handful of his executives visited Xerox PARC, Xerox's innovation center in Palo Alto, California. While on the tour, the Apple executives were shown one of the new technologies Xerox had developed, called the Graphical User Interface. The Graphical User Interface allowed people to use a computer without learning a computer language, like DOS. Instead, with GUI, users could, for the first time, use a mouse to move the cursor on the screen to click on visual icons and folders that were sitting on the desktop. If the vision was to empower individuals, this one innovation would make it possible for even more people to use computers than could before. After the Apple executives left Xerox PARC, Jobs shared his idea. Apple had to change the course they were on. They had to invest in GUI. One of the executives, attempting to be the voice of reason, spoke up. "We can't," he said. He reminded Jobs that Apple had already invested millions of dollars and countless man-hours on an entirely different direction. Abandoning that work to ostensibly build a new product from scratch would add significant strain on the company. According to Apple folklore, the executive went on to say, "Steve, if we invest in this, we will blow up our own company." To which Jobs replied, "Better we should blow it up than someone else." A more finite-minded leader would be hard-pressed to simply walk away from an established strategic path, especially if it included walking away from any significant time or money that had already been invested or the promise of a performance bonus. Despite the cost and the stress it would put on the company, to Jobs, an existential flex was Apple's only option. The just cause directed his choice, not the cost of the choice. And Apple's employees agreed. The people who loved working at Apple loved that Jobs pushed them to do things that neither they nor anyone else had done before. And with that, they set themselves on a path that in just 4 years saw the introduction of the Macintosh, a computer operating system that completely revolutionized personal computing. For the first time, the personal computer really was easy enough for just about anyone to use. Microsoft was forced to follow Apple's lead. Nearly 4 years after the introduction of the Mac, Microsoft released Windows 2.0, the first version of Windows to look and feel like the version many of us use today. It is software that was designed to make a PC work like a Macintosh. If you don't blow it up, someone else will. "As convenient as the pencil," said the advertising. "You press the button, we do the rest." That pretty much summed up George Eastman's vision when his company, Eastman Kodak, introduced the first cameras ever to be sold to the general public. This was the late 19th century, and photography was almost exclusively performed by professionals and serious hobbyists back then. Regular people just couldn't take their own pictures of their families or vacations. The equipment was bulky and heavy. The chemicals required to treat the photographic plates were highly toxic. It was complicated and expensive. But Eastman was obsessed with simplifying photography for the masses. Though he made early advances in how photographic plates were coated, his real breakthrough came when he invented a way to completely replace the heavy plates with a type of cellulose nitrate plastic called celluloid. Originally used to make the dental plates that hold in dentures, we are more familiar with its modern use, film. Having brought photography to the masses, Kodak went on to become one of the biggest companies in the world, and George Eastman one of the richest men. And following his death in 1932, the company went on to further advance Eastman's cause. Always looking for ways to give average folks better ways to capture their own memories, in 1935, Kodak introduced the first commercially successful color film for the masses. This also paved the way for color motion pictures and color home movies. Kodak also invented the slide projector, with a round tray that made it easier and more convenient for people to share the pictures of their vacations, weddings, and anything else they could force their friends and family to sit down to watch. In the early 1960s, Kodak invented the film cartridge, making photography even simpler and more convenient. Now, people who struggled or were intimidated by threading film onto a spool in their camera only had to plop the film cartridge into the back of the camera and they were off to the races. Literally, if that was their thing. And in 1975, the R&D department developed something truly remarkable, the first digital camera. But there was a problem. Though going digital was an obvious next step for the company to advance its just cause, the problem was the invention of digital photography directly challenged the company's business model. Kodak made money on every part of taking pictures. They made the cameras, the film, the flash cubes, the machines that processed the film, the chemicals that were used to develop the film, and the paper the pictures were printed on. Everyone knew that the new digital technology would render their current business obsolete. If George Eastman or any other infinite-minded leader were at the helm, this wouldn't be an issue. They would see the new technology as a better way to advance the cause, and they would figure out how to reconfigure their company. Sadly, the cause had been brushed to the side at the executive levels. Finite thinking now dominated. They were no longer making decisions to advance the cause. They were making decisions to manage the costs and maximize their near-term financial standing. Lacking any sense of vision whatsoever, when the executives at Kodak were first shown the digital technology, their initial reaction was that people would never want to look at pictures on a screen. The executives told their engineers that people liked their pictures on paper and there was nothing wrong with paper. Steven Sasson, the young engineer who is credited with inventing the digital camera, tried desperately to get the executives to imagine the future of photography 20 or 30 years ahead. Much to his dismay, his leaders had no interest in advancing the cause and certainly no stomach for any decision that would upset the status quo, especially when the status quo was working just fine and was quite profitable for them personally. They had no appetite to upset Wall Street or go through what would have been the short-term hell of blowing up their own company in order to advance their just cause and remake Kodak into a digital company. And so, abandoning Eastman's vision, instead of making the existential flex they needed to, they decided instead to suppress the new technology for as long as they could to stave off the inevitable. When you're talking to a bunch of corporate guys about 18 to 20 years in the future, when none of those guys will still be at the company, they don't get too excited about it, said Sasson. Every digital camera that was sold took away from a film camera, and we knew how much money we made on film, Sasson continued. Of course, the problem is pretty soon you won't be able to sell film, and that was my position. Instead of leading the digital revolution, Kodak's executives chose to close their eyes, put their fingers in their ears, and try to convince themselves that everything was going to be just fine. And I guess it was, for a time. But it didn't last. It couldn't last. Finite strategies never do. Now that the digital genie was out of the bottle, Kodak predicted that it would take about 10 years for other companies to seize on digital photography and make it a thing. And they were right. About 10 years after they first invented the digital camera, Nikon, the Japanese camera company, introduced an SLR camera that Gave uses the ability to attach an external digital processor to the body, which was made by Kodak because they own the patents. But it was Fuji, a much smaller Japanese film company, that in 1988, exactly 100 years after Eastman introduced the first film camera for the masses, introduced the first fully digital camera to the market. Nikon later partnered with Fuji, and together they continued to innovate and refine the technology. About 10 years after that, Sharp, a Japanese electronics company, introduced the first cellular phone. And 10 years after that, by the mid to late 2000s, digital cameras and cell phones with built-in cameras both became the norm. Kodak did own many of the original patents related to the digital technology, and they made billions of dollars from those patents, which gave the false impression that they were doing well as a company. The finite-minded leaders falsely believed that a strong balance sheet equaled a strong company. It doesn't, at least not in the context of the infinite game. When Kodak's patents ran out in 2007, the money dried up, and 5 years later, Kodak filed for bankruptcy protection. Bankruptcy is so often an act of suicide. When we look back at the decisions that put once successful companies on a path to bankruptcy, we discover an uncomfortably high number of leaders who were obsessed with the finite game. Their cause abandoned, instead they are left desperately clinging to business models that may have helped them become successful, but could not stand the test of time. In most cases, it's not the market conditions or the new technology or any of the other stock reasons usually offered as explanations that are responsible for their company's demise. It was the leader's inability to make the necessary existential flex that was the problem. If they had abandoned their cause, they also abandoned their capacity to flex. Call it existential inflexibility. At some point, every single organization will need to make a flex. Though that need might not happen during one particular leader's tenure, part of any leader's responsibility is to build their organization with the capacity to exercise existential flexibility should they or their successors need to do so. That means adhering to the just cause as a guiding light and maintaining a culture rich with trusting teams. The opening sentence of the January 19, 2012 announcement of Kodak's bankruptcy in the New York Times summed it up perfectly. Eastman Kodak, the 131-year-old film pioneer that has been struggling for years to adapt to an increasingly digital world, filed for bankruptcy protection early on Thursday. A statement from the chief financial officer, Antoinette McCorvey, revealed the very finite game Kodak's leaders were playing. Since 2008, the statement went, despite Kodak's best efforts, restructuring costs and recessionary forces have continued to negatively impact the company's liquidity position. The leaders of a once great infinite company had abandoned their moral responsibility to advance Eastman's just cause in favor of a perceived responsibility to more finite ambitions. They allowed forces of the market, not a passion for the vision, to dictate the company's future. And the entire company, the people who worked there, the town of Rochester, and their shareholders had to pay the price. These days, Kodak exists as a shadow of its former self. At the time Kodak invented the digital camera, the company employed about 120,000 people. Now they employ about 6,000. Though the company still makes film and all the products that go with processing film, ironically, its entire business primarily services one market today: professional photographers. The final nail in the coffin, they had completely abandoned their founding just cause. Without a just cause to guide them, Kodak's executives lacked the vision or courage to know what to do for the long-term success of their company. The most they could do was react to the world around them. George Eastman literally invented mass-market photography. The people who worked at Kodak were pioneers in almost every part of the industry. It was only their finite mindset that left this once great company to be disrupted by the visionary technology that they themselves invented.